we are going to fight and struggle and buy and sell and trade and swap and steal to control the available fuel resources. We forget this earth is a bottle and that it only has so much in it. And when what is in it is gone, it is gone. And it takes millions of years to replenish an exhausted petroleum field. Therefore, this whole situation is fraught with the greatest danger. And this danger is summed up in the concept of profit. We are willing to sell our birthright for a bowl of potash, in this case, a bowl of petroleum. But we are using our means for the wrong ends. What we should be doing is trying to understand the world we live in, trying to know what the world rewards and what it punishes, and learn to know how to use and not abuse what we have. In Rome, an old farmer once dug up a pot of gold in his field when he was plowing. He didn't know what to do with it, so he wrote a letter to the emperor, and he said, "I have found a treasure in the earth. What shall I do with it?" The emperor wrote back two words, "Use it." The farmer thought for a while, and he wrote another letter to the emperor, and he said, "I don't know how to use it." Again, the emperor returned two words, "Abuse it." Now, this is more or less our problem. Not knowing how to use what we have, we misuse it. Instead of attempting to cooperate with a value that is far beyond money, we are bound together in a struggle for worldly possessions. Now, this does not mean that we should go off the deep end and all impoverish ourselves. This is not the end. The end is understanding. The individual who is pried loose from his wealth is in a very unhappy condition. But the individual who outgrows excessive possessiveness is a very wise person. And we need more of that kind of persons at the moment. So here we are with a situation which has been intensified by materiality. Now, materialism is an attitude. It is something that some people seem to come by naturally. Others achieve it by great effort. And still others have thrust upon them. But in all principle and in all fact, materialism is simply a point of view. It is an attitude towards something. It would have remained such if it had not been for the fact that it has been scientifically organized. Science coming along without a religious leadership has aided and abetted human selfishness. It has devoted its researches and most everything that it has done to proving materiality, to prove that we live in a world in which skill takes precedence over honor. We have become very skillful. And for probably the 100 years from the middle of the last century on, we have become increasingly proud of scientific progress and increasingly indebted to its productions. Now, science has done a lot of good. No one is going to say that it hasn't. The principles of science are philosophical. They go back to the dawn of time. Man began to be a scientist the moment he decided to improve his state. Science in itself is not bad. We're not running down scientific achievement. What we are concerned with is the fact that science is not self-disciplined. That science, instead of advancing the cause for which it should be advancing, has gotten sidetracked. An astronomer looking out in the sky cannot but be impressed by the magnitude of the universe and the comparative insignificance of himself. We look out upon an orderly way of existence. We're now not only hunting out galaxies, we are looking for holes in them. We are going on exploring space. But something about this exploration has been frustrated. When we explore space, what does it mean? What do we learn from the recognition of an infinite reality superior to anything that man can even understand? How are we going to advance scientifically unless the scientist thinks beyond the boundaries of materialism? Not only are we indebted to him for the exploration of nature, but we are indebted to him for all kinds of byproducts. And as we study these byproducts, we realize that many of them are also completely focused upon materiality. We find an educational system which is deficient in the most important thing in the world, and that is spiritual conviction. We find every profession, every art, every trade becoming more skillful, becoming better able to administer its various activities, but with little or no insight as to meaning. The meaning is lost. Where the meaning is lost, where the idealism fails, where all principles are downgraded to a large degree, where we are entertained only for the benefit of the advertisers, we are gradually becoming more and more disillusioned and are gradually being internally injured by an attitude which is unworthy of a human being. This means that we are coming gradually to an impasse. We are trying to project materialism and make it the key to the universal procedure, and it is not. And no materialist has ever been able to prove that it is, or ever will. We are losing our souls, just as surely as Faust sold his immortal soul to Mephisto for a few years of riotous living. This lack of the basic integrities has produced another effect. We have lost this consolation of spirit. We are undermining the friendship of nations. We are having massive difficulties with racial problems. We have all these difficulties, and we have no remedy. So the only thing we do is fall back upon a misuse of what we think might be a remedy, and that is to focus all our attention upon wealth. Wealth is something that you can reach out and touch. Wealth is something you can spend today. Wealth is something you can accumulate for good or no good reason. But wealth becomes the goal of life. Just as the ancient dreamed of being better, the modern dreams of being richer. We have taken materialism, supported it by science, perpetuated by education, and have now accepted it as the key to universal security. This is simply poor thinking. In fact, it is so impoverished that it almost denies our essential humanity. Therefore, wealth is now the guiding spirit. It has taken over, and everything is measured in terms of it. The materialist, not believing in anything after death, has still further reason to enjoy the moment. Now, in enjoying the moment, we find that wealth is not only something that has to be accumulated, but it has to be administered. Now, one thing we should all learn, and nature probably would uphold us in this lesson if we would ever settle down to it, is that wisdom is the proper use of what we have. Wisdom means that we should apply all of our effort and our worldly goods to the advancement of something that is superior to the delusion of mortal superiority. We need to have, therefore, some approach that will give us a key to the situation. At the moment, we may say that science has not the high reputation that it had 50 years ago. We do not look upon it as we did. Even a new mythology such as Star Wars doesn't completely compensate. In fact, it almost illustrates the problem. Actually, we are now in the midst of a positive application of the universal law of cause and effect. Science, without understanding, without spiritual leadership, without the integrities that come from philosophy, the modifying forces of art and literature, the testimonies of history, and all of the other contributing factors, science is in serious trouble. It has given us, as far as we can judge, the ultimate dilemma, the hydrogen bomb. With this, science could wipe out not only man, but himself and itself. Destroy everything that has been accomplished, because that accomplishment was not built upon a solid foundation of internal integrities. As long as we continue to exploit the universe, we will suffer from our own exploitation. Wealth, therefore, must be used. Millions of dollars, billions of dollars, have been contributed to the advancement of science. Therefore, those paying the bill have a right to know that what they have supported is supporting them, that it is accomplishing for each of us a better life, that it is building securities instead of fomenting insecurities, that it can look forward to centuries of peaceful cohabitation between creatures upon this planet. Science should have led us to a golden age, but it got in trouble. It got tied up with the age of gold. And they are different things. So the use of money becomes the next responsibility. Use or lose was an old adage of Ben Franklin's, and it was a very good one. If you have, and you want to earn what you have, suppose you inherited it. Suppose you've earned it with your own hands. Suppose you get it as in return upon your investments. Whatever it is, whatever is your opportunity, is your next responsibility. Therefore, it is up to the individual and to society in general to make sure that those things which we have are rightly used. If they are rightly used, we justify them. If we use them as they should be used, there could be no reasonable complaint against them. But something must happen to cause the individual to assume responsibility for the use of what he has. This responsibility means thoughtfulness. It means that the person settles down to the wise administration of his own affairs. It means that he curbs his appetites, that he strengthens his moralities, that he functions upon a level of ethics and is consistent and reasonable in his conduct. These things deserve wealth, whatever it may be, because it means that ultimately this wealth will be returned to its own source and the whole world will be better. But what of the individual who doesn't think? He comes home with a very substantial paycheck. He doesn't realize, of course, that no matter how big it is, it does not actually represent value. But having received it, and having more of it than he ever had before, what does he do? He goes into various extravagances. And at the present time, alcoholism is one of the byproducts of money not well used. Another byproduct is narcotics. Another byproduct is luxurious and extravagant means of life. Life that transcends the necessary, the reasonable, and the proper. Now, it is the extravagance of the rich that has brought about practically every revolution in the history of the world. The individual who thoughtlessly and in vanity advertises his superior financial standing is a danger to his community. The great Japanese shogun, Ieyasu Tokugawa, was well aware of this. And when he became military dictator of Japan, one of the first things he turned his attention to was the bankers of Osaka. The bankers were a very close-knit fraternity, and in the trading with the Netherlands and later with other countries, they were very prosperous. And pretty soon, their wives and daughters, and even themselves, began to show evidences of luxury. The ladies wanted to wear the most expensive fabrics. The gentlemen wanted to have the most expensive fittings on their swords and on their in their sashes. The children were dressed to kill. Everyone was going along, living it up, to use a non-Japanese term. Ieyasu saw this, so he simply passed a law. Any person of wealth who exhibits this wealth excessively shall have his entire fortune confiscated by the state. They just took it away from them. He said, if we do not curb extravagances, if we continue to confront the people with the misuse of wealth, it will destroy the nation. Now, he lived around he was a dictator in the early 17th century, but he made his point very clear and made it stick, that ostentation is the basis of anarchy. Now, we all know these things if we read history. Read Gibbon's Decline of the Roman Empire, I'll tell you the whole story. But why are we continuing in this way? Why are we overlooking? Why are we allowing a perfectly wonderful life to be wasted by dissipation? Or why we allow a thoughtful mind to be dedicated only to trivia? Why is this possible in a world in which man has been endowed with higher faculties and powers? Well, one of the answers, of course, lies in this problem of the lack of philosophical guidance. Someone asked in a newspaper not long ago for the name of two or three outstanding American philosophers. The editor replied, there are not any. There are plenty of scientists and economists to burn, and there are also all kinds of politicians, but there are no philosophers. And this lack of true philosophy has corrupted music, art, literature, clothing. It has corrupted human relationships. It is contributing to crime. It is breaking homes. It is creating millions of narcotic addicts, because now cocaine is one of the symbols of luxurious living. What's happening? The values have been forgotten. The true reason for wealth has been forgotten. The proper use of what you do have must be restored if you want to solve the existing problem. There is no other solution. Discipline, in this case, needs leadership. Now, where do we go for leadership in idealism? Well, we can look around, and it seems to be in short supply. But we have a tremendous reservoir of it, which we are neglecting, and that is religion. Religion has been in head-on collision with materialism, because unless materialism discounts religion, its own position is impossible. So it is easier to deny religion than to correct the faults of science. But in spite of all the ups and downs, we have on this planet a reservoir of probably 2.5 billion religion-oriented people. It is the largest existing social group. It excels all others in number and in basic instruction. It has much to contribute. Yet we will study the history of the Roman Empire. We will study the problems of the Renaissance. We will try to investigate what was wrong with the Medici. And we will also try to prove conclusively why Alexander died under the battlements of Babylon. And yet in our public school system, we are afraid to even mention the world's greatest unit, religion. There is no other part of human society that is more significant, has a longer and more unusual history, has had more ups and downs, and has been the cause of greater good or greater ill than religion. And yet we are not even allowed, really, to consider it as part of an educational system unless we go to a theological seminary. Now, we are quite in harmony with the idea that it probably is not proper in a democratic country to favor one religious group over another. This is in violation of a constitutional amendment which is primary and proper. But to face the fact, frankly, there is no reason why religion cannot be part of education, where it can be studied as one of the major institutions of human society. We should never be afraid or ashamed to mention it. We can approach it historically, we can approach it philosophically, but we do not need to become involved in theological disputes. But without some kind of idealism, and where are we going to find it? Where are we going to find an idealism that is a substitute for the Sermon on the Mount? And why do we need a substitute? So our monetary system, in order to straighten itself out, should read Scripture a little more attentively to find out what it's all about. Our present economy that we are so proud of is not practical. It is not factual. It cannot survive the forces that are now gathering around it unless it becomes enlightened. It must begin the problem or accept the responsibility of the recognition of the responsibilities of success in any field or department of life. How would we go about to instrument this? Well, we know that it's going to be heavily opposed. We know that everyone is going to have some reason why he doesn't want it. But the fact remains that gradually, that which we cannot control, and that is destiny, is stepping in. What man cannot handle, he must leave to heaven. And up to the present time, heaven has been keeping the galaxies in fair order for uncounted billions of light years. So we might have a little confidence in it. In this sense of the word, then, we notice with marked interest that what man does not voluntarily assume, he has thrust upon him. Within the last 25 years, there has been a great resurgence of religion. The individual placed in a condition absolutely precarious to his survival is beginning to think in terms of his own inner life. There are probably more persons attending church at the present time in proportion to the population than ever before since the end of the 18th century. We are gaining the realization that we must change ourselves, and we must gradually build our foundation not upon a material anthill, but upon an internal integrity which is infallible. This change is making inroads in every phase of our living. We are becoming more and more addicted to the idea of solving something. Communities are taking over their own projects. There is greater consideration for the unsolved problems. And most of the leaders in these better movements are either religiously or philosophically oriented. They believe in something above matter. They believe in something which can bestow upon mankind a true and proper guidance, a guidance which can lead him out of the present dilemma. One problem, I imagine, is the same that faces nearly everyone, and that's fear. Fear can be a very dangerous and terrible thing. But the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, according to the Bible. Now, the translation of that word fear from the original Hebrew is not the best choice of words. It was not actually terror or something of that nature. Fear, in this case, is used more or less philosophically to suggest or imply that we are afraid of our own evil. That we fear the law of life if we break it. That we therefore would rather not break it and not bring down a retribution upon ourselves. But actually, man in his fear looks someplace to turn. He's looking for a place to find the means to get a home when he can't find a place to live. He's beginning to be afraid of inflation. He is afraid of energy limitations. He is afraid of a corrupted ecology. He is afraid of his neighbor. He is afraid of every institution which has exploited him down through the years. Therefore, fear ends in a kind of philosophical desperation. The individual finally decides that he has to reorient his own life and put his faith in that in which there is a right of faith. And the motto of the country, "In God We Trust," is coming true. We are beginning to realize that it is not entirely safe under existing conditions to trust anything else. So, to find this faith, we have to look inside. We have to take the experiences of the day and distill from them something valuable. We cannot turn away this experience because we didn't like it and accept this failing because it seems pleasant. We're going to have to get down to basics, to a real foundation in values. It will come. Many people are very much disturbed and disappointed about all this, but I think very much definitely it will come. We are going to wake up. We were created to wake up. And it has been a long and tedious procedure. But in spite of all of his mistakes, humanity has survived. He is here. He is on and he is working. And little by little, he is beginning to discover a heart in his work. He is beginning to see that if he uses the natural resources of his planet wisely and unselfishly, we can all live together in comparative security. We can find ways of making our lives useful and beneficial and a source of inspiration inside of ourselves. Under such conditions, if we land in the judgment hall of Osiris, we will pass with shining honors. We will be safe. And our safety beyond this life is beginning to be more important to us. We are beginning to realize that there are many things we have hoped for here which are not going to happen. But we must recognize that no individual who is dedicated to principles can fail. Failure is a term in economics which means you do not succeed economically. But real failure has nothing to do with economics. It has primarily to do with the lack of internal growth. Therefore, a challenge is the most important thing in the world. And at this moment, the challenge of our economic system is the most pressing problem that we have today. We are talking constantly about trying to balance a budget. We are not in any position at the moment to balance it, according to the best we can find out, because when we think we have it balanced in one direction, it tips over the other. We are not going to be able to balance a budget until we integrate ourselves as human beings. If we are able to do that which is right, we realize that all the benevolences of life come from a power beyond ourselves. The fruit on our trees, the grass that grows under our feet, everything that we have belongs to a natural law, a natural procedure in space. We can benefit from it. We can be wonderful gardeners in the garden that has been given to us. But when we subdivide it and sell it off, we are in trouble. This world is a world ruled by one divine plan. This divine plan does not object to the reasonable use of an economic system. It does not forbid or prohibit accumulation, but it does demand right use. And right use is something that we have to think about quite a bit these days. I remember many years ago in New York, I had talked with a very successful woman who was in finance. In those days, she was not able to sit on the stock exchange and had to work through brokers. But she had a large estate. One day we were talking, and she said, "You know, there's nothing in the world that I would enjoy more than to become aware of the philosophic and religious values of life. I would like to settle back to contemplate some type of reality beyond the stock market." But she says, "I can't. I'm completely locked. Every day is another problem. If I do not keep my mind on this, I'll be wiped out. I have to give my life to protecting what I have." Someday we're going to have to realize that we must give our lives to protect something that we are. And that if what we have makes it impossible for us to grow, then we are in very serious situation. So our problem with money is to use it as it was intended, as a medium of exchange, as a way of accomplishing a simpler social relationship, as an indication of the integrity of the seller and the buyer, and to make possible involved transactions of a world ever increasing in population, which must find ways to universalize its needs. We have to have these media, but they have to be in the hands of enlightened persons. They have to be freed from overambition. We have to be freed from monopoly. They have to be freed from ulterior motives. We have to learn what is the truth about some of these factors and situations. There is a revolt against most of the prevailing institutions simply because we can't live with them, because they make us sick. We are forced to take on, in daily living, exploitation policies which make us sensitive to values that do not actually exist and lose sensitivity to that which is true. The beginning of wisdom and the beginning of solution is that the human being must grow. And this growth is going to come, and he cannot prevent it. But the main point is that when growth begins, the individual must be open to it. He must be glad that it happens. He must value a magnificent experience far above a possession. He must put the possession of his own life in his own hands and lead it correctly. We have been given a kind of free will, which is really only a power of choice, as Aquinas points out. But we have the right of making decision. And day by day, more people are making better decisions. And these better decisions will ultimately prevail. But they may only come when some situations become so desperate that we cannot survive without them. We're going to grow. We're going to succeed. We're going to use the instruments we have created. We are going to use all that science can give us. We're going to use philosophy properly. We are going to use our economic system constructively. We are going to organize our industrial structure so that all will have a fair part in the resources of nature. We will gradually integrate our religions, breaking through barriers of creed and sect, until finally we come into the realization that religion is merely man's effort to interpret from within himself the great laws of life under which he lives. These things will come because man will survive. I noticed coming down here this morning, I went over a little piece of property where there were stones set together. And between two little blocks of concrete so close together that you could hardly put a knife blade between them, a little plant was growing. It was just a little weed, but it was certainly having a hard time. And yet it had adjusted to its need magnificently. It survived what would normally be called an irresponsible and inevitable defeat. It survived because there was life in it. And that life was stronger than concrete. That life was going to be lived if there was any human possibility or natural possibility for its survival. We are much more important than that little plant, though perhaps in the universe it might take precedence in some matters. But in general, each individual has survival built in. He has the power forever to overcome that which he outgrows, become wiser, better, and nobler in all of his dreams and all of his aspirations. Success, eternal fulfillment is his, and a great cycle of lives which we must live, life after life, ensures the ultimate salvation of all that lives. The main thing is not to make it quite so hard on each other right now. If we're all going to survive, if we're all going to be ultimately enlightened and true and honorable, cooperative and loving and friendly, we might as well start now as wait until we get some more black and blue marks. There is no reason why, if the end that we seek is peace, that we shouldn't start to do everything we can to promote it now. And while we cannot always change others, we can come gradually to a relationship with life by which we understand the eternal benevolence that guides us through sorrow and misery to the fulfillment of our own purpose. Children make mistakes, but they outgrow them because they learn better. We are children. We have made mistakes. We are making mistakes. The only problem that is important is that we shall outgrow them. And we outgrow them by living above them, by changing our own attitudes toward them, by using all material things as symbols of spiritual values and spiritual realities. We need to have our dollar bill and sold. And that cannot be done at the mint. The ensoulment of a dollar bill is up to the individual who holds it in his hand. If he uses it wisely, he gives his own soul to it, and it serves the common good. If he uses it unwisely, it is but an empty body to go down to mortality. So it is up to us to ensoul the good, put new spiritual dimensions upon the institutions that could serve us well, but which we have permitted to fall into decline because of our own selfishness. We cannot be selfish and happy. We cannot be overambitious and live in peace. We cannot break the rules of life without a power that is greater than ourselves stepping in. We know this from experience. It is time for us to respect, regard, and love that power that steps in, for it is our hope of salvation. Thank you very much.